Hey everybody, for the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, bringing you the latest readout video from our free Wednesday Wake Up email newsletter, to which you should subscribe, and also a big howdy to the folks in Dallas who have made that city number 17 on our all-time list of views by city. Also, hello from the cat, and please get off my keyboard. Now, we are a bit behind in the newsletters, so I'm reporting on one that was written while COP29 was still going on in Baku, Azerbaijan, although I had by that time arrived safely home despite various follies with my luggage outside of Azerbaijan, of the sort that you might have thought would be more likely while I was in Azerbaijan. Still, although the conference was still going on, our newsletter began by declaring it a failure and saying, yes, we did tell you so going in. And the reason why is that they've been holding these things, obviously, for 29 years now. That's why it's COP29. But a couple of years ago, they gave up on limiting greenhouse gas emissions, which had kind of seemed to be the whole purpose of it. And instead, they were just going to get rich countries to give poor countries a whole bunch of money to help them either not emit greenhouse gases, even though they were going to, or mitigate the damage that was supposedly occurring to them due to bad weather that was supposedly caused by us. And we knew perfectly well, and they should have too, that the rich countries were not going to come up with the kind of money they wanted or anything like it. If they were willing to, they'd have said so ahead of the conference. And if they hadn't said it publicly, they'd at least have said it privately, so they'd have gone to Baku knowing they had a great announcement to make. But they didn't, the result of which is that the conference failed before it even started, and while it was going on, and then, of course, when it ended. Now, in the newsletter, it's not all COP all the time. We did also talk about the fact that, okay, it is all COP all the time. We talked about the fact that Azerbaijan is a petrostate. And this, of course, was a kind of tactically awkward thing about this host and the last one, which was Abu Dhabi. But it was also awkward intellectually because the fact of the matter is that Azerbaijan, and let's be fair to the place, doesn't have a whole lot going for it. Not in terms of its history, which has seen one band of marauders come tromping through after another, some that you've heard of, like Tamerlane, and some that you haven't, like Qajar Iran, and one that you certainly had, the Soviet Union. So, amidst all their lack of resources and difficult history, they've got one thing going for them, and that's oil. And to tell them, never you mind that, just live mired in poverty and insecurity, was never going to impress their government, and it certainly didn't. And it wasn't going to impress a lot of other governments either. So this conference really was a non-starter, though it started anyway. Now, in the newsletter, we also, I'm not kidding, it's not all COP all the time. We did also mention that at one point one of us was searching for airline flights and was offered one with, quote, below average CO2, end quote. Which, if you believe we cared about that, that's a bit odd to begin with. And if you actually believe that this tube, this metal tube full of human beings is going to take off at sufficient speed to get up to 5 miles in the sky and then move people from one continent to another without giving off a lot of CO2, then maybe there's a bridge in Brooklyn we could also interest you in. We did also note the resignation of the editor of Scientific American over her fulminating against Donald Trump in obscene fashion, which she then said didn't reflect her beliefs. I'm not sure whose beliefs she thought they did reflect or how that person's beliefs had come out of her fingers. But anyway, she went left to go bird watching. So the question is, will Scientific American drop its obsession with progressive politics and climate, or will it just continue to spiral downwards? Time will tell, and so will we, because otherwise we don't do Time Will Tell here at CDN. We also have noted the fatuity of politicians who think they can redesign entire economies without ever having run a corner store. And so BlackRock's reporter points out that Canada's former environment minister, who's now over at Natural Resources, but seems to think he still has his old job, presides over a department that, quote, to date has subsidized about 6% of the charging ports it predicts Canada needs to comply with electrical vehicle mandates, end quote, and has spent $1.2 billion not getting anywhere significant. So, would you let this man decide that everyone has to drive EVs? Would you trust him to tell us that that's a fine arrangement that won't disrupt our way of life when he can't even build plugs? At CDN, we would not. Oh, and speaking of tunnel vision, the Canadian government does keep finding new ways to funnel money at to electric vehicles and insist that one day we'll thank them for it. But not today. Because focus groups that were convened by that same government to prove that they were great and popular found instead, and this is black box again, that a lot of Canadians think EVs are too expensive, won't cause a jobs boom, and that their manufacturing has an ugly environmental footprint. So apparently the voters of all things know more than the government. As Jay Budziczewski once said, people are logical slowly. The Canadian government does not have that attribute. Also, a Net Zero Watch press release complains that, quote, another wind farm surpasses £1 billion in subsidy payments, end quote. It's the fourth one in Britain to do so. And here we were told that renewables were now cheaper than conventional energy. Think also of what else might have been done with that money in all kinds of areas, including the fact that the British government has just cut fuel subsidies for the poor during the winter. That £1 billion would have kept a lot of people comfortable, even if the government had already made it necessary for them to get a subsidy so they won't freeze. And another thing, climate alarmists frequently suggest that those of us who are skeptical of orthodoxy are in it for the money, that we are venal liars. Thank you very much. And they also frequently imply that we are getting enormous quantities of it from big oil or some other source like more big oil. But the curious fact is that if you're following the money, it's not us that have most of it. Canadian correspondent asked us if we'd seen the Canadian delegation while we were in Baku, and we explained that they weren't hanging out with the hoi polloi. But the other thing that is worth noting is that the Canadian government managed to send 270 people. I promise you, CDN didn't have the cash to send, fly 270 people to Azerbaijan. And when our environment minister did flit in, make an announcement and flit back out again, his announcement was that he was giving over $1 billion to something that will fix the weather. Once again, if only we had $1 billion, never mind so much money that we could toss billions around as though it was chump change. And what else have we got here? Oh yeah, Deutschland, Deutschland unter Wasser, with apologies to those people who think my German pronunciation is bad as it is. Because the delegates gathered at COP29 are being confronted with an inability to carry out what they say must be done. And this is really kind of embarrassing. But it's not just them, right? If that were true, we could just get other delegates. They're confronted with countries that have really tried to implement the Green Dream and had it go terribly wrong. And none of them is more dramatic than Germany with its fabled Energiewende, which at one time was meant to be the lodestar for all of us. But the simple fact of the matter is that go woke, go broke isn't just for companies anymore. It works for G7 economies, and the Germans have proved it when it comes to climate policy. And a small glimmer of hope here. Gavin Schmidt, he's a leading government climate alarmist, and he goes by Climate of Gavin on X. But he has just made the admission of Gavin in the New York Times, along with another of his fellow true believers, that's Zeke Housefather. They have said the science is not settled. Gosh, really? Why didn't someone tell us? Oh, wait, we did. But there's a specific point here, and I actually shouldn't be too sarcastic because it's good that Schmidt and Housefather are actually willing to admit that something has happened that is contrary to their expectations and their dogma. That's what real scientists do. And the specific point is this, quote, "The unusual jump in global temperatures starting in mid-2023 appears to be higher than our models predicted, even as they generally remain within the expected range. While there have been many partial hypotheses, new lows, sulfur fuel standards for marine shipping, a volcanic eruption in 2022, lower Chinese aerosol emissions, and El Niño perhaps behaving differently than in the recent past, we remain far from a consensus explanation, even more than a year after we first noticed the anomalies, and that makes us uneasy," end quote. And funnily enough, it has the opposite effect on us, because what makes us uneasy is when scientists talk like cultists, chanting the same thing over and over in an eerie monotone. When scientists talk like scientists, we feel a lot better about the whole business. So good for them noticing this, and let's keep on looking at how reality's not really matching what their models are saying, because it's a bigger phenomenon than just this one spike in heat. In the newsletter, we've wrapped up our cheerful chart series. It went on longer than we'd expected because there was actually so much cheerful news. But now we're on to a new one called Green Blackout. And this is about the fact that the IPCC in particular doesn't want to talk about the fact that rising carbon dioxide levels have led to an impressive planetary greening. And an impressive planetary greening doesn't just mean that there are now plants on hillsides where there didn't used to be. I mean, some environmentalists might say, oh, great, more plants. And others might say, oh, boo, no, everything is precious just the way it is. But I'll tell you what a lot of those plants are, crops. And in lots of places in the world where hunger still stalks humanity, the fact that there are more crops, I think, is unambiguously a good thing. So what's the story here? Well, the first place we look is in the summaries for policymakers. The IPCC does some good scientific work, and it goes on at great length, and then it produces these summaries for policymakers that are actually kind of written by the policymakers for the policymakers to reflect what they wish the scientists had said, not what they did say. But these ones certainly don't reflect anything on the subject of global greening. They just don't talk about it, because all effects of CO2 are meant to be bad, and all bad things are meant to be effects of CO2, and virtually everybody who likes plants, from farmers to gardeners to people who eat food, think more plants are a good thing. We also produce a few quick observations on the subject of climate science, including the idea that governments really have to stop nitrous oxide emissions, and they're doing all kinds of weird things to farming, speaking of not having enough food, in the name of that, at least in the advanced world. But actually, it turns out that the effect of nitrous oxide is tiny, and it really isn't worth worrying about. We also note that a Dutch Court of Appeals has overturned a lower court decision that ordered Shell to cut its emissions by 45%. And we can't help thinking, when governments tell oil companies stop selling oil, it would be an interesting demonstration, sort of a pilot project, if they just stopped selling oil in that country and saw how it went. However that may be, this was a piece of lawfare that we're glad to see has, at least for now, been deflected. We also note that Kenneth Richard over at No Trick Zone talks about a new paper by a Greek hydrologist who actually once again managed to show that if you don't take the dogmatic view in your programming that CO2 causes warming, human contribution to the overall greenhouse effect is actually negligible. So there's all kinds of science out there that dissents from the dogmatic orthodoxy. And it really is important that everybody who's at all interested in the subject give it a fair hearing. And finally, Tony Heller over at realclimatescience.com. And Heller is just marvelous at going through the archives and finding, among other things, proof that the weather's always been terrible. Found a historical write-up of a terrible storm that hit the Great Lakes in November of 1835. Yes, 1835, before we had climate. Sank 19 ships, killed 254 sailors. And had World Weather Attribution been around at the time, you can bet that their method would have said, ah, that's because of human CO2, because their method pretty much always says that. Finally, from the CO2science.org archive, as we customarily wrap up our newsletter, we have a study on garden beans. Now, perhaps not everybody's favorite vegetable, but nevertheless, there it sits, Physiolus vulgaris L. And a number of experiments have shown that, yes, more CO2 makes it grow better, just as you'd expect once you figured out that it is a plant. So, for the Climate Discussion Nexus, I'm John Robson, and I'm back from Baku saying, told you so, wasn't worth it, though it was worth going to see. And thank you to all those again who helped make it possible for us to do that.